goal of taking back control. Bianca Rahimi, London.
And as these negotiations go down to the wire behind closed doors, both Brussels and London must be mindful of public opinion on this ultimate game of brinkmanship. Well, as are we. So we took to the streets of the capital and got some reactions.
It's a pretty difficult position, to be honest. The negotiations have been going on for 4 and a bit years, so you'd hope that they got to a resolution. But at the end of the day, you want a good deal rather than a deal that would compromise our rights. And personally, I think the main area is services. We haven't done a good job enough to the city. We're focusing on fishing, which is a massive part of our GDP. We should be looking at other priorities. So not too happy that that's turned into a political statement rather than an actual business one.
Economically, for sure, it would be worse off to leave the EU in the short term, but it might be better in like the medium to long term. But that depends on what kind of deal they struck, or if there is no deal, then I think nobody knows what will happen.
Well, I think there's a lot of brinkmanship going on, and I guess something will magically resolve itself before the end of the year. What kind of deal that is, I don't know, but I think the French are being over-demanding on the fish, so they might have to give way on that. The Germans want to sell us cars and wouldn't want tariffs, and yeah, we want to sell and trade in Europe, so there's probably a bit of give and take on both sides, I guess.
But I believe in God, and that whatever will be, it will work out okay, and we'll all be all right in the long run. So I'm relaxed about it, basically.
I think that there kind of needs to be extension, but every time they always leave it till the last minute to rush these deals, and then they say they haven't got enough time. So I'd say they have an extension, but then are they just going to repeat the same thing again? Are we just going to have another few days left and then have to have another extension as well? So
I mean, it can't go on for much longer, because the European people, they're just getting more irritated and more irritated. I mean, now Macron is getting very vicious altogether, and I'm not English, but you know, when you look back on what the English did for the French during 2 world wars, they saved them from annihilation, and yet the French can turn around and be very vicious when they feel like it. So get out now is my advice.
Yes, it sounds to me as though there's a certain amount of lack of goodwill on both sides, I suspect. I don't feel that everybody's making a huge effort necessarily, at least not from what's reported. I'd be slightly surprised if there were an extension. It feels like the British government would quite like to get out of there with no solution. That's what it feels like to me, anyway.
Some other news now, as more unrest in France as protest against police violence and a new draft security bill quickly disintegrated into clashes as police used tear gas and trenches in an attempt to disperse the crowds. The march began peacefully enough, with thousands of people waving banners and chanting slogans against the government and the police. However, violence soon erupted.
To see all the police present surrounding us is crazy. It's as if we're criminals. The government treats the protesters as criminals.
This means a lot to me. I was a victim of police violence in April last year. I took a hit from a truncheon by a riot policeman, which broke my neck. Since then, I've been scared of the police. I no longer trust them, and I will never trust them.
Weeks of protests have forced President Emmanuel Macron to take another look at his draft security law, which criminalizes the video recording of police. Macron also acknowledged that ethnic minorities were more likely to be stopped by police after footage emerged of officers assaulting a black music producer. Police unions have responded angrily to the president's comments. While Chris Denhond is in program, Macron has said he will take another look at this controversial security bill. But will this be enough?
Protesters, they demand, and because the actual, the current existing laws are more than sufficient to punish criminal behavior. So there is also a second problem for Macron. People inside his government, the high government circles, they want to rewrite the law because they are not happy with the way that the French government is dealing with the security issue. And then there is a third element, inside the Senate, with a right-wing majority, they also want to rewrite this law. So it will take a while before this law will be applied, it will be put into practice, and in the meantime, it's very probable that the protests will go on.
Now, Macron is dealing with not just this situation, but accusations of Islamophobia. Tough times for the French president here, Chris.
Yes, well, he positioned himself, since he is president, in the center of the political spectrum. But, in fact, his political practice, he is looking to his right and even to his far right. So he is copying parts of the far right party of Marine Le Pen concerning Muslims, concerning migrants, and concerning the way the security issue is dealt with. His problem is, the more he looks to his right, the more there is discontent on his left. So it's a dangerous situation for him, because when there were terrorist attacks, the public opinion, also under influence of the mass media, is going to the right and to the far right. But if he goes too much to the right, there is a real discount on the left, and people go, they take the streets, and when the lockdown is less severe and when demonstrations are authorized, which happens last weeks, people are on a massive way participating in demonstrations.
Now, on a final note, and very quickly for me here, Chris, he's got elections in April of 2022. This must worry him right now, the fact that he doesn't quite seem to be getting the balance right.
Well, he is really preparing his these elections. It's in less than a year. And the same thing, he is looking, the main danger for him is coming from the far right, Marine Le Pen, National Front Party. And on the left side, the progressive side, there are different candidates, like Mélenchon, the Communist Party has a candidate, there will be other candidates. It's more divided. His main danger to be re-elected comes from the far right. That's why he's looking to the right at the moment.
All right, problems ahead there for the French president. Chris Denholm, thank you.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Robert, in Lakesh, 9,000 new Jewish homes in a Jerusalem area here in Al-Quds. I mean, this pays total lie and a sham to any ideas of peace, surely.
Absolutely. The Zionist entity has just approved 9,000 settler units, and specifically a settlement which is located in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. It's called Atarot. Now, Atarot settlement will essentially isolate once it's expanded with these 9,000 settler units. Isolate Ramallah to the north of East Jerusalem from East Jerusalem itself. And it's part of this larger effort by the Zionist entity to attempt to cut off Jerusalem al-Quds from the Palestinian people and prevent it from being a Palestinian capital in the future. We know that under a two-state solution, the Palestinian capital is supposed to be based in Jerusalem al-Quds and East Jerusalem al-Quds. And the other settlements, of course, in that area, like Givat HaMatos and also Ramat Shlomo, are also being expanded. So it's part of an effort by Israel to specifically attempt to isolate Palestinians from East Jerusalem al-Quds. On top of that, right now, they're undergoing a large-scale ethnic cleansing program inside of East Jerusalem al-Quds, with a massive expulsion campaign going on. And whilst they're demolishing Palestinian homes, around 400 Palestinians have been made homeless just in East Jerusalem al-Quds this year alone, which is a phenomenal figure. This is really should be alarming. However, the international community it has failed time and time again to act. In fact, the statements coming out from them aren't even strong enough on these sort of things, let alone any sort of action coming about. So it just shows the international community is not in favor of actually delivering peace.
Indeed, and we have to remember, of course, that Netanyahu has elections, so this might be another pivot towards that.
Absolutely. This is something that Netanyahu, he will use to pander to his far-right base. And it's sort of projected that Netanyahu will go after trying to install a far-right religious government along with Naftali Bennett and his party, which, of course, if he's going to do that, he has to bring on the settler bloc. And this is, of course, 800,000 people, so there's a lot of people he's pandering to there.
Well, you know, it doesn't matter if Palestinian lives are at stake. If you can get your grubby hands on a few more votes. On to the social media reaction here, Robert.
The first one we've got here says, a two-state solution has been impossible for some time. Palestinians now need simple rule over their state. We have another one here as well commenting on this who says, we can all thank the UAE for recognizing the fascist apartheid occupation to stop this happening. Oh, wait, never mind.
And we move from an occupation entity to, well, what's going on in Michigan there?
Well, another settler colonial project, of course, is having its far-right moments. Donald Trump's crowd seem to be riding on the wave that has been created of this culture war, and actually threatening the Secretary of State over, of course, what's going on to do with the voting system in Michigan. And we've seen that this is not just in one state. We've seen that armed Trump supporters around the country belonging to a lot of white supremacist groups as well have been threatening a lot of state officials and have even attempted to kidnap state officials for what they see as a threat on their rights and liberties. And of course, Trump is fueling this all the way. He's still not accepting his defeat to Joe Biden. His supporters absolutely do not accept his defeat. Even though he hasn't accepted the defeat, he is accepting that he's not going to be inaugurated again in January, as he's running a rally on that day, a pro-Trump rally he's going to be running on Inauguration Day. So it doesn't seem that he'll actually turn up there, as traditionally has been followed by presidents who lose their position or have completed their time in office. And Trump looks to be running, to wanting to run in 2024. So it seems like this will go on for some time now.
Nothing's been traditional about this system, and perhaps just really shaken America's facade of democracy there. But your online reactions, the ones that you've scoped out, would be of interest to me.
The first we have here says, is this the well-regulated militia described in the 2A? Question mark. I think not. More like a dangerous group of right-wing nuts emboldened with deadly weapons. We have another one here as well who says, Trump's behavior and rhetoric has emboldened his swamp to be criminally aggressive. This is not news, but things have heated up in Michigan. Trump needs to be held accountable for the actions that he encourages.
All right, Robert Inlakesh, obviously we'll continue to monitor the two stories you brought to our attention. Thank you. In some other news now, into Spain we go, because hundreds of far-right Vox supporters gathered in several major cities over the weekend to voice their contempt for the COVID-19 restrictions being imposed by the government. Speaking to local news outlets, protesters stated that, quote, Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez had taken away their freedoms and destroyed the economy. Also attending the protest, Vox party leader Santiago Abascal said that the constitution was at risk as the COVID-19 restrictions were eroding the rights of citizens. Counter-protests were blocked by police from congregating in the same area as Vox demonstrators to prevent clashes. 70 COVID-19 clinics have opened in the Russian capital just days after President Vladimir Putin ordered a large-scale immunization program. During a news conference, President Putin declared that the Russian-made Sputnik V vaccine will be made available to groups most at risk to the disaster, with the list including doctors, nurses, teachers, and social workers. Earlier last week, Russia's health minister, Mikhail Murashko, also announced that the country had already tested the vaccine on more than 100,000 of its citizens. So far, Russia has reported more than 2.4 million confirmed COVID-19 cases, the highest in Europe, with over 43,000 deaths. And of of course, Ahmed Kabalo, back with us for social media, and this time we're talking Iranian tankers on their way, laden with oil, to Venezuela.
Yes, and this is apparently the largest fleet of oil tankers to date, and it defies the US ban. Now, this is again another example of Venezuela and Iran's cooperation, and both countries have many similarities. Both are anti-imperialist countries, both are countries with huge, large oil reserves that the US wants to get its hands on. But what's interesting about these countries, in many ways, is in their own region, there are many client US client states that are hostile to them both. So in Iran, we have client states like Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, that are trying to attack and undermine the Islamic Republic. And in Latin America, you have states like Colombia, Brazil, Chile, who are again working within the US interests and trying to undermine the Bolivarian revolution there. So what they've done is they look for alliances not only in their region, but they've looked further abroad and they've found some sort of cooperation, and they're willing to support each other because they're in the same boat. Elliot Abrams is the US special representative for Venezuela and Iran, and he wants to overthrow and implement regime change in both of their countries. Now, Anya from the Gray Zone is actually in Venezuela at the moment, and she says this: the US-led economic war against Venezuela has brought Caracas and Tehran closer together. Iran broke the blockade against Venezuela this year, delivering much needed crude and even opening a grocery store in the country. I found this mural in central Caracas. Not everyone agrees. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who's equally as hostile to Iran as he is to Venezuela, says this: Venezuela used to be a prosperous country. Under Maduro's corrupt and incompetent rule, the people of Venezuela are suffering. The US is helping the Venezuelan people in tangible ways, and we support a return to democracy through free and fair elections.
All right, now, let me just intervene for a second there, Ahmed, because this strikes me that perhaps I can be so bold as to call him the outgoing Secretary of State here. He makes this statement without a hint of irony. Is it not America that's backed the last destabilizing events to try and topple the legitimately elected government in Venezuela, Ahmed?
Yeah, in the last 18 months, they sponsored three coup attempts that have failed miserably. Now, the suffering that he talks about in Venezuela are the result of US sanctions. The Center for Economic Policy and Research, a Washington, D.C. based think tank, that says US sanctions have killed 40,000 people in Venezuela in 2017 alone, and the sanctions have intensified since then, so only God knows what the real figure is at this moment in time. So it's a bit rich to say that, and it leads us on to our next story, actually, because on December the 6th, there have been elections in Venezuela for the National Assembly. Now, the indications show that the PSUV coalition has won that with 80% of the votes counted, showing that they've got 67% of the vote. Yet the mainstream media, who seem to be acting in cahoots with the US State Department and the British Foreign Office, are very much trying to delegitimize the results. So this article from ABC says, Venezuela's Maduro claims sweep of boycotted election. What they fail to acknowledge is that Juan Guaido, the opposition leader, was polling at 3%. Now, when Venezuelans polled asked him if they believed he told the truth, only 4% said they did, that they believed him.
Ouch.
So it shows that, yes, they boycotted the election, but they boycotted the election because it showed that they had no chance of winning. And if they were to participate in an election in which they were to lose by a substantial figure, it would only strengthen Nicolas Maduro's position. So what they chose to do was boycott an election which they knew they couldn't win. Now, you've got this tweet from Venezuela Analysis, a fantastic source for anything regarding Venezuela. They say, BBC reporter just said results are a foregone conclusion because only government candidates are running. The State Department wouldn't have said it any better. 14,000 candidates, 100 plus parties, most of them opposition, are running. The BBC's low standards are the only foregone conclusion. Now, this election is very important because the National Assembly in Venezuela is, by its constitution, it needs to rectify international trades and international treaties. And what the opposition-led National Assembly were doing previously was they were boycotting and this and refusing to pass any legislation and supporting sanctions against their own country, hence why they were so unpopular within the country.
Final tweet, Ahmed?
Final tweet from Kenneth Roth. He's from the Director of Human Rights Watch. He says, Venezuela's election Sunday is a theatre piece meant to lend a veneer of legitimacy to the government of President Nicolas Maduro, who spent the last 7 years jailing opposition opponents, tearing apart opposition parties, and using extrajudicial killings and to stifle dissent. Now, obviously, he says that without a hint of irony,
indeed,
because Juan Guaido has tried many coups and he walks around freely.
All right, we'll leave it there. Ahmed Caballo, thank you. We'll keep an eye on that one. And, of course, thank you. Take care.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Globally, more than 64 million cases of COVID-19 have been recorded, with nearly 1.5 million deaths. The World Health Organization's Director of Emergencies, Dr. Michael Ryan, speaking from Geneva, Switzerland during the first dialogue, said even with vaccines on the horizon, we're still in a very, very dangerous and difficult situation. He explained that some countries, particularly in the Americas and in Europe, are still experiencing major virus transmission. Although the situation in other regions may be stable, some of the countries still battle continued or returning transmission. He stressed, "We will be able to add vaccines to the current control measures, but let me be clear, vaccines or vaccination do not equal zero COVID." He added, "We must add vaccines to the existing parcel of measures that we have in place. As the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has remarked, the pandemic has been the greatest challenge to the global community since the organization was founded 75 years ago. But according to David Beasley, Executive Director of the World Food Programme, WFP, it has also sparked international action that includes recovery plans and economic stimulus packages. We have prepared for you an article written by staff writers at news.un.org under the heading, UN says right decisions on COVID-19 now will secure a life of dignity for all. Please stay with us for more. The second and final day of the United Nations General Assembly's special session devoted to the coronavirus crisis, UN Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed said critical decisions made now to address the COVID-19 pandemic would lead to a life of dignity for all people. The head of the United Nations agencies, along with scientists and other stakeholders, held interactive dialogues focused on the health and humanitarian response, the road to vaccines and addressing the socio-economic impact of the crisis on Friday, 4th of December. UN Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed outlined United Nations support for countries going forward, including mobilizing the $28 billion needed to secure vaccines for all, regardless of wealth and location, and assisting authorities everywhere to operationalize inclusive recovery plans. She said, "This session comes at a critical moment. If we make the right decisions now, we can meet the humanitarian needs, reset the development pathways, accelerate implementation of the Sustainable Development Goals, and secure a life of dignity and opportunity for all on a safe and healthy planet." UN General Assembly President Volkan Bozkir said in his opening address, "We cannot neglect our duties to the people we serve at this time of crisis, when it is even more important. COVID-19 has affected the entire planet and, by extension, every area of the United Nations work. Although the pandemic is a global health crisis, impacts have varied across countries, as have responses to the crisis." According to the head of the World Health Organization, WHO, who delivered a speech from its headquarters in Geneva, Switzerland, while many countries have been able to prevent or contain the virus through proven public health measures, this is not a fluke of geography or demography. World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said these nations have proved the efficacy of science, solidarity, and sacrifice, paraphrasing a motto he has used throughout the pandemic. Ghebreyesus stated, "But where science is drowned out by conspiracy theories, where solidarity is undermined by division, where sacrifice is substituted with self-interest, the virus thrives, and the virus spreads. Globally, more than 64 million cases of COVID-19 have been recorded, with nearly 1.5 million deaths." World Health Organization's Director of Emergencies, Dr. Michael Ryan, speaking from Geneva, Switzerland, during the first dialogue, said, "Even with vaccines on the horizon, we're still in a very dangerous and difficult situation." Dr. Michael Ryan explained that some countries, particularly in the Americas and in Europe, are still experiencing major virus transmission. Although the situation in other regions may be stable, some of these countries still battle continued or returning transmission. Dr. Michael Ryan stressed, "We will be able to add vaccines to the current control measures, but let me be clear, vaccines or vaccination does not equal zero COVID." He added, "We must add vaccines to the existing parcel of measures that we have in place." United Nations Secretary General has remarked, the coronavirus pandemic has been the greatest challenge to the global community since the organization was founded 75 years ago. But according to David Beasley, Executive Director of the World Food Programme, WFP, it has also sparked international action that includes recovery plans and economic stimulus packages. However, David Beasley warned that next year is literally going to be catastrophic, as humanitarian needs double, with famine already knocking on the door of some 12 nations. He adds, as war drives hunger, fighting also must cease. Urging countries to step up, David Beasley said, "We can avert destabilization and famine and migration, but we've got to be out there sooner rather than later." He noted, "If we're strategic and put the funds of those particular icebergs before us, I believe that we can get through 2021 whilst we work with the vaccines and rebuild the economies so that we can have a better world and achieve zero hunger by 2030. The zero hunger target is among the 17 Sustainable Development Goals, which all 193 United Nations member states adopted 5 years ago. The Sustainable Development Goals provide a blueprint for ending poverty, protecting the planet, and ensuring that all the peoples of this world live in peace and prosperity. Achim Steiner, administrator at the United Nations Development Programme, UNDP, said, "The goals remain absolutely relevant because they are our compass for getting out of this crisis." Among the lessons that the United Nations Development Programme learnt from the pandemic has been the importance of having good data, critical for targeting people in need, particularly in times of crisis, while issues relating to human rights and gender are now part of recovery plans. The administrator at the United Nations Development Programme, UNDP, underlined the importance of the United Nations work in responding to the socio-economic fallout from the coronavirus pandemic, which has disproportionately affected women and the poor. According to a United Nations Development Programme-backed study issued recently, he warned that more than 1 billion people worldwide could be living in extreme poverty by the end of the decade if we do not manage to make the right choices now. He added, "But actually, the opposite is equally possible. This is the moment. It is a generational moment in which we need to think about the future of development in very different ways."
Saudi Royal Family.
Part 2.
The sword has always been a beloved and vital object in the House of Saud. In the early 20th century, they expanded their kingdom in Saudi Arabia, relying on Wahhabi and Bedouin people called the Muslim Brotherhood. Even hundreds of years later, the sword is still prominent in Saudi royal family's glorious festivals with leaders of great nations of the world. But now, the Saudi royal family is spending petrodollars to buy modern arms, and the sword, that is a relic of the past, is the only ornament of the events. But all these arms purchases have not been able to help maintain the glory of this family in critical moments, as it did 100 years ago. Today, the Saudi royal family needs the sword even more than when they took power in the Arabian Peninsula with the Muslim Brotherhood swords. Bandar bin Sultan received an Airbus A340 just as one of his birthday gifts, one that was worth $75 million. This gift is decorated with the color of his favorite football team, Dallas Cowboys. Saudi Arabia began arms purchase in the 1960s, a time when Saudi oil revenues were rising and growing every day. Jeffrey Edwards, a businessman from Yorkshire, traveled to Saudi Arabia to sign civil contracts in 1962. Later, he realized that there was a profitable market for arms sales. When Faisal bin Abdul Aziz Al Saud came to power in Saudi Arabia, West Asia was at the height of the Arab Cold War. Saudi royal family sought to protect Saudi Arabia from the region's growing dangers by purchasing modern Western arms. This contract was signed officially in December 1965. It included 42 BAC Lightning aircraft and a number of aerial surveillance systems. Saudi Arabia and Britain entered into tough and breathtaking negotiations to sign a historic arms deal called Yamama. The deal could save Britain's bankrupt economy led by Margaret Thatcher. He made a great profit in this historic deal, and it made him one of the key players in Saudi royal family. In the following years, he reached an important position in the country's foreign relations, which was specially related to Washington and London. Beirut, March the 8th, 1985. A powerful bomb exploded in a southern suburb of Beirut, targeting Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Fadlallah's life. He was known as the religious leader of Lebanon's newly formed Hezbollah movement. Years later, the famous American journalist Bob Woodward reported that William Casey, the then head of the CIA, and Bandar bin Sultan jointly led that explosion. Bandar was responsible for financing the $3 million budget for this operation. The blast killed 80 people around the mosque and injured 200 others. Old friend of the Saudi royal family who was favored by the regime for the past decade attacked the small neighboring country, Kuwait. It happened shortly after the arrival of Yamama deal orders in the early 1990s. Iraqi forces quickly crossed the Kuwaiti border into Saudi Arabia and occupied the Saudi border town of Khafji. Concurrently, Saddam Hussein controlled a significant part of the region's oil fields, and Iraq's continuous military presence could threaten Saudi oil reserves. Yamama and all other arms deals did not help Saudi Arabia stop Iraq's invasion. The King of Saudi Arabia supplicated to the U.S. government. Afterwards, a high-level delegation from the U.S. traveled to Riyadh to help Saudi Arabia deal with the Iraqi army. Iraqi forces crossed the Kuwaiti border and occupied part of Saudi territory. Members of the Kuwaiti royal family were staying at hotels in London and Europe, and King Fahd was worried about the same repercussions.
In my direction, elements of the 82nd Airborne Division, as well as key units of the United States Air Force, are arriving today to take up defensive positions in Saudi Arabia. I took this action to assist the Saudi Arabian government in the defense of its homeland.
George H.W. Bush immediately sent his envoys to Riyadh to sign large contracts to drive the Iraqi Ba'athist army out of Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. The U.S.-led coalition was made up of 35 countries and 1 million troops. 700,000 of these troops were Americans. One of the targets of this operation was to dismantle the Iraqi war machine, which was equipped in the 1980s with the direct help of Arab countries, especially Saudi Arabia, to fight against Iran. But they had to shut it down because it was a threat to the entire region. Retreat, Iraqi forces set fire to hundreds of oil wells in Kuwait and turned this country to a burnt land. The U.S. Air Force also fired uranium bullets at a convoy of troops with stolen Kuwaiti military equipment and vehicles on the Kuwait-Basra Highway, turning it into the Highway of Death. Political, security, and environmental consequences of this war left the region in a state of crisis for many years. The Saudi army, which was worth tens of billions of dollars, was practically inactive, and it was the armies of other countries in the world that rushed to its rescue. During the first phase of Ayyamama deal, Banda received £1 billion. A great part of the money was deposited into accounts in the main branch of Riksbank on Pennsylvania Street, just across from the White House. These accounts belong to members of the Saudi embassy, including Bandar bin Sultan, as well as official embassy accounts. It is an ideal bank for presidents, embassies, and ambassadors with close ties to the CIA. George W. Bush's uncle, Jonathan Bush, was the bank's chief executive. The strange point was that in 1999, a significant amount of this money was transferred from the account of Bandar's wife at the same bank to the accounts of two of the 15 Saudis involved in the 9/11 attacks, named Khalid al-Mithar and Nawaf al-Hazmi. On May 4, 2004, The Guardian newspaper revealed allegations of corruption in Ayyamama deal. Several people in the Saudi royal family, as well as British politicians, were involved in this case, most notably Bandar bin Sultan and other Saudi princes such as Turki bin Nasser, deputy commander at the Royal Saudi Air Force, and Margaret Thatcher's son in Britain. But the directors of the BAE were the most important entities involved in Britain. The Guardian newspaper claimed that the company had bribed Bandar bin Sultan an amount of £1 billion during the deal. The Guardian's investigation showed that the BAE, with the assistance of Lloyds Bank, set up a secret network to transfer money to Red Diamond Bank accounts in the Virgin Islands to pay large bribes to politicians in various countries, including Saudi Arabia, in exchange for military contracts.
I mean, I can certainly assure you, I mean, that we, and I believe most companies, are not in the business of making payments, passing, as you suggest, large sums of money to employees of governments. I mean, it is just not the way, I mean, business is done.
Serious Fraud Office, or SFO, as part of the UK Attorney General's Office, started an extensive investigation. This department followed the links of this case in Britain as well as in the US. The continuation of this investigation caused concern to Saudi officials because they were looking for the third phase of Al Yamama deal. It was time for Bandar to return home because the investigations into his financial records as well as the follow-up of the press were causing problems for him. On September the 8th, 2005, he returned to Saudi Arabia. At the same time, Saudi Arabia threatened Tony Blair, the new British Prime Minister, that it will suspend its security cooperation with London on terrorism if they did not stop their investigation. Blair seriously warned all the members involved in the investigation, including the British ambassador to Saudi Arabia and the British Attorney General. Blair urged everyone at all levels to stop the investigation because it could threaten the British citizens' lives.
I don't believe the investigation incidentally would have led anywhere except to the complete wreckage of a vital strategic relationship for our country in terms of fighting terrorism, in terms of the Middle East, in terms of British interests there.
But threats became reality.
Breaking news we're getting from the PA Newswire that there's been reports of an explosion outside Liverpool Street Station.
July 7th, 2005. London bombings that killed 52 people and injured 700 others was a clear signal to the British government that it was time to end the investigation, and they stopped it shortly. The strange thing was that a few months later, Prince Bandar bin Sultan was the head of the Saudi National Security Council, and he was in charge of terrorist groups' files, including Al-Qaeda. In 2007, when the media controversy over corruption in Al Yamama deal subsided, the Saudi king traveled to London and Bandar accompanied his father in the Saudi delegation. They had several meetings and Saudi Arabia signed a $20 billion contract with the BAE. Most countries were trying to take advantage of this lucrative market, but the United States was trying to get the most out of it.
Over the past 30 years, the United States has sold over $50 billion worth of military weapons and services to the Saudis, more than we've sold to any nation on earth.
And we have had, for more than 40 years now, a relationship and an agreement, mutual security agreement, with the Saudi Arabians. And it has been beneficial to both of us.
Saudi Arabia has had the largest arms purchases from the U.S. among Arab countries since the 1950s. But the U.S. has been trying to play a bigger role in this market. This time, Washington was not worried anymore about shifting the balance of power between Saudi Arabia and Israel. As Barack Obama took office, many around the world hoped that U.S.'s approach to war and arms sales would change.
Holofernes, the Nobel Peace Prize laureate for 2009, President Barack Obama, to come forward and receive the gold medal and the diploma.
He was the fourth U.S. president to receive the Nobel Peace Prize in his first year in office.
So yes, the instruments of war do have a role to play in preserving the peace. And yet this truth must coexist with another, that no matter how justified, war promises human tragedy. The soldier's courage and sacrifice is full of glory, expressing devotion to country, to cause, to comrades in arms. But war itself is never glorious, and we must never trumpet it as such.
But the story was different. The interests of military industry were so great that all U.S. governments, both Democrat and Republican, sought to gain a greater share of this market. The Obama administration broke the record by signing the highest arms deal with Saudi Arabia in the history of relations between the two countries. According to Pentagon figures, the Obama administration exported $278 billion in arms sales to the world during his 8 years in office, and delivery of orders to Saudi Arabia alone amounted to $115 billion. After the Arab Spring protests in 2011 calling for change, Saudi Arabia worked hard to maintain its trusted friends in those countries, including Yemen and its former president Ali Abdullah Saleh, who was a Saudi royal family's old friend. Saudi Arabia could help Saleh, but they found another alternative. While the Yemeni government was trying to designate Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi as the president, economic and security problems were increasing day by day. Yemen's popular Houthi Ansarullah movement was trying to control the situation in Yemen by cooperating with individuals and parties such as Ali Abdullah Saleh, and the situation was getting better to some extent. This news was not in favor of Saudi Arabia, a country that had been influential in Yemen for years, so it started a bloody war against Yemen, a nation that is one of the most deprived Arab and Islamic countries. Yemen became the target of the most severe ground, aerial, and maritime strikes after a complete siege on this country. Saudi Arabia launched its offensive on March 25, 2015, forming a coalition of Arab governments and Western countries. The United States and Britain provided intelligence and weapons for Saudi Arabia on its war on Yemen. According to Saudi media, the offensive was supposed to end in a few days or at most a few weeks and the new government would fall, but the war continued for months and years. Saudi Arabia entered a battle in which it only had to be the winner and the other side had to surrender and lose.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.